Hi, this is Jane on Monday, August 24th, reading the Patriot Ledger, August 24th edition. USPS issues final rule on mail-in voting. Injunction blocks it from taking effect. The U.S. Postal Service published a final rule, August 21st, to tighten requirements for mail-in voting ahead of the November congressional elections, despite a court order blocking the changes from taking effect. USPS said it was issuing its 95-page rule so it could take immediate effect if a court lifted its injunctions on it. Under the rule, USPS would not deliver ballots in states that do not comply with the rule's new standards. USPS's final rule requires states to provide lists of voters who received mailed ballots to the agency. Last week, U.S. District Judge Indira Talwani in Boston blocked USPS from adopting those rules ordered by President Donald Trump ahead of the November elections that will decide control of Congress. Trump signed his executive order in March after years of calling for tighter rules on voting by mail and pushing the false claim that his 2020 election defeat was the result of widespread voter fraud. The rule, which was posted late August 21st, will be formally published August 26th. USPS will take no action to implement the order unless a court lifts the injunction. USPS referred questions to the White House. Under the rule, if it takes effect, USPS will not collect or record party affiliation and will not inspect ballot contents. Postmaster General David Steiner defended the plan in June, saying the Postal Service is making sure we match the ballots that a state believes they're sending out to what actually gets sent out. Many states and Democrats in Congress have argued USPS does not have authority, and it is too close to the election to change election rules. The final rule would require states to provide the USPS with the names and barcodes tied to their mail-in ballots for federal elections. Embryo personhood debate gains notice. HHS guidelines add to movement's momentum. About 100,000 babies were born through in vitro fertilization in 2024, according to the most recent U.S. data. But IVF commonly involves trying to create multiple embryos because success is never guaranteed. If unused, those embryos can be frozen, discarded, donated to research, or donated to another fertility patient. In the eyes of some anti-abortion activists, those frozen IVF embryos are already children, children who need to be adopted into families. And that idea now appears in a federal document, grant guidelines announced by the Department of Health and Human Services in June. The department's Embryo Adoption Awareness and Services Program has existed since 2002, but this year's funding notice describes IVF embryos as children who already exist and are in need of a family, rather than presenting embryo adoption as one option among many for patients with remaining embryos. The document describes the practice as centered on embryos' rights and best interests. This language draws from a decades-long movement to give personhood status to fetuses and embryos, including those made in fertility clinics. The personhood movement is rooted in a belief embraced by many conservative Christians that human life begins at fertilization and should receive legal protection from that moment. Embryo adoption occupies a niche corner of U.S. fertility care, but the notice brings far-reaching questions about reproductive politics into sharper focus, including the future of IVF, a fertility treatment that many of those same conservative Christians support. In my 2023 book, Conceive in Christian America, Embryo Adoption and Reproductive Politics, I show how embryo adoption developed as a Christian pro-life response to the accumulation of embryos remaining after IVF, recasting embryos as vulnerable children requiring rescue. once a fringe view, even among anti-abortion activists, that claim is now moving closer to the mainstream of reproductive politics. Some fertility patients who no longer plan to use their frozen embryos donate them to other patients in the United States. An embryo is transferred through contacts and clinic consent forms, after which it can be transferred into a recipient's uterus. The small network of agencies, nonprofits, and churches that offer embryo adoption recast the donation process as one that saves preborn children. Modeled on domestic adoption, many programs require home studies that assess prospective parents and their households. Many also allow donors to select who receives their embryos and encourage families to get to know each other rather than remain anonymous. Legally, embryos in the United States generally are not adopted because states do not classify them as children under adoption law. Instead, they are often transferred by contract as personal property. The distinction between donation and adoption is part of a larger political project. Advocates seek to change how the public understands embryos and ultimately how the law classifies them. As one advocate for embryo personhood told me in 2008, what we call things matters. Adoption language gives the process some meaning and some dignity, he said. By recasting IVF embryos as children deserving protection rather than as surplus tissue or research material. The world's first embryo adoption program was launched in 1997 by Nightlight Christian Adoptions, which also facilitates traditional domestic and international adoptions. But the idea emerged from a longer effort that began taking shape in the 1960s, led largely by conservative Christian organizations, to establish legal personhood from the moment of fertilization onward. In 1973, the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade ruling found that the Constitution protected the right to have an abortion, a decision grounded in the right to privacy, stemming from the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause. But the majority's opinion also observed that the case for abortion rights would collapse if a fetus were recognized as a person under the 14th Amendment with a constitutional right to life. It was a watershed moment for personhood politics, and anti-abortion strategists responded quickly. One week later, Maryland Representative Lawrence Hogan proposed the Human Life Amendment, which sought to extend constitutional personhood to the moment of conception. Similar efforts repeatedly failed in Congress and at the ballot box, including a prominent 2011 measure that Mississippi voters rejected. As IVF advanced, the treatment raised new questions about when and where personhood begins. Some anti-abortion advocates extended claims about life beginning at fertilization to embryos created outside the body, but IVF was not one of the movement's main targets. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, debates over human embryonic stem cell research drew national attention to what happens to embryos that remain after IVF. Scientists and patient advocates viewed embryos remaining after IVF as valuable materials for research that might lead to treatments for serious diseases. To anti-abortion activists, however, using embryos in research destroyed human life. Embryo adoption entered the debate as a life-affirming alternative to discarding them or donating them to research. President George W. Bush brought families from Nightlight's embryo adoption program to a White House press conference opposing expanded federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. These children helped convey Bush's message that there is no such thing as a spare embryo. Embryo politics changed dramatically in 2022 when a new Supreme Court ruling, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, overturned the constitutional protection for abortion. Before Dobbs, persuading courts to recognize embryos and fetuses as persons had been a potent but divisive goal among anti-abortion groups. Some embraced it, while others favored a different strategy, in part because public support for IVF is so strong. After Dobbs, however, activists intensified efforts to extend legal rights to embryos and fetuses. Personhood arguments now surface in not only abortion restrictions, but also disputes involving pregnancy loss, child support, and taxes. Fertility care in particular has moved toward the center of anti-abortion politics. Alabama became a bellwether in 2024 when its Supreme Court ruled that frozen embryos created during IVF treatment qualified as children under the state's wrongful death law, which allows parents to sue over the death of a child. The case arose after a patient entered a fertility clinic's cryogenic storage area and dropped a container holding frozen embryos. Concerned about liability, clinics paused services, and the state quickly passed a law giving providers immunity for embryo damage or death during IVF services. Today, the Health and Human Services funding notice signals a shift toward the personhood movement's central premise that embryos are children. Embryo adoption occupies a small corner of U.S. fertility medicine. Few people choose to donate remaining embryos for procreative use, nor is embryonic personhood a popular idea. Only 39% of Americans support laws declaring that human life begins at fertilization. A majority of white, evangelical Protestants, Hispanic Protestants, and Latter-day Saints support that view. Yet majorities of these religious groups also oppose banning IVF. But embryo adoption's political power has never depended on widespread participation or public support. It lies in the story the movement tells about what embryos are and advocates' efforts to embed that story in institutions, policies, and law. I would argue the funding notice is one sign that the personhood movement is gaining force after the Dobbs decision. The question it raises is what legally recognizing embryos as children would mean for reproductive health and rights. Spike in school supply costs hits parents. Brands cite higher prices from gas and import duties. Brandy McGrath usually buys quality, long-lasting school supplies for her 9-year-old son and his teachers, but sharp increases in the cost of folders, pencils, and other products have forced her to cut back and search for cheaper alternatives. "It's insane how expensive things have gotten," said McGrath, 48, of Salt Lake City. "I'm looking for every sale I can." In Daytona Beach, Florida. Karen Kaiser was similarly struck by the cost of back-to-school shopping this year. "It's crazy," she said, estimating that she and her husband spent over $100 on just notebooks and loose-leaf paper for their two daughters. That's not counting what we had to pay for back-to-school clothes, shoes, and haircuts. The cost of a typical school supply list, including notebooks, paper, pencils, and glue sticks, is nearly $175, almost 8% higher than in 2025, according to an analysis by the Groundwork Collaborative and the Century Foundation, two progressive think tanks. Some essential items, such as lunchboxes, notebooks, and tissues, cost 20% or more than they did a year ago, the analysis found, pointing in part to the effects of President Donald Trump's tariff agenda, which the Federal Reserve said raised the cost of many products manufactured overseas for American consumers. Over the same period, the cost of electronics, such as headphones, rose 6.6%, the report found. Meanwhile, typical lunch items cost 10.9% more than they did in 2025, the analysis said, citing price hikes on products including blueberries and deli meat. The rising prices come as Americans are already struggling with inflation and high gas prices stemming from the war with Iran, forcing many to take on debt and stretch their meals. A survey by Credit Karma found that 57% of parents are entering the back-to-school season with credit card debt, and nearly half plan to pursue new credit to help pay back for back-to-school expenses. Major school supply brands have increased their prices in recent months, citing inflation, rising gas prices, and tariffs. Newell Brands, which owns well-known school supply brands such as Sharpie, Expo, Paper Mate, and Elmer's Glue, increased prices to offset more than $170 million in tariff costs. ACCO Brands, which owns school notebook supplier Mead and Five Star, cited costs from tariffs and conflict in the Middle East as headwinds that will lead to higher prices for consumers. "We do anticipate having to push through additional cost increases globally," said Thomas Tedford, president and CEO of ACCO Brands, in an earning call in July. The Trump administration has said the higher prices will be temporary. As traffic through the Strait of Hormuz normalizes, energy prices and thus overall inflation will come down and real wages will rise, White House spokesperson Kush Desai said in a statement. President Trump's economic agenda delivered historic working-class prosperity in his first term, and this same agenda is cleaning up Joe Biden's mess to deliver more job, wage, and investment growth. McGrath, who leads her local parent-teacher association, said she compared receipts from 2025 with what she spent this year and was flabbergasted by the difference. "I was paying a dollar a piece for basic folders last year, and today they were $2.79," she said. About 62% of back-to-school shoppers said they were likely to seek out sales this year, according to an annual NerdWallet report. A quarter of respondents said they plan to cut back on school-related spending, and 72% said items such as clothing, school supplies, and electronics feel noticeably more expensive this year than in 2025. Jenny Craig of Ormond Beach, Florida, said she spent hundreds of dollars more on school supplies for her three daughters this year than she did last year. "To keep costs down, she tried to save where she could. I said no to the $1.50 folders that are nicer simply because they have a cute cat on it," she said. "We got the plain 49-cent folders instead." Across the country, tens of thousands of parents are lining up for free backpacks, notebooks, and other supplies for their children. Many groups organizing these fundraisers say they've seen the need for donations rise sharply over the past several years. The Brevard Schools Foundation, which serves children and families in East Central Florida, went from giving free backpacks to about 3,100 students in 2023 to supplying them to nearly 5,000 children last year. Families continue to face rising costs for school supplies, while teachers regularly encounter students who arrive without the basic materials they need to learn. Joan Perry, a spokesperson for the foundation, told Florida Today, part of the USA Today network. The new school year arrived at a time when families were already struggling to afford everyday expenses. Studies have shown more Americans are dipping into their savings and taking on debt to cover essential payments on housing, food, and rent. In a June survey, 30% of respondents said they used a credit card to pay for essentials in the past 3 months, knowing they may not pay off their bills. Chase Miranda, 36, of Indian Lake, Ohio, said he and his wife have fallen behind on rent and utility payments just to afford groceries, especially after their food stamp benefits were recently cut by half. Trump slashed funding for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program in 2025 in a move the White House said would strengthen the program to serve those who need it most. More than 4 million people are estimated to have lost food benefits since the Republican-backed legislation took effect. Miranda, who's unable to work because of chronic pain stemming from scoliosis and bulging discs in his back, said the cuts meant he couldn't buy his 12-year-old son anything new for the upcoming school year. "Until we get enough money saved up, he'll use last year's supplies," he said. In Salt Lake City, McGrath hosts fundraisers and collects supplies for her son's elementary school. This year, she has brought in about a third of the donations she usually receives. It's hurting everyone, she said. Trump's beef price plan faces pushback in GOP. President Donald Trump said he will ease tariffs on up to 300,000 metric tons of ground beef imported into the U.S. for the next 90 days in a bid to reduce the prices Americans are paying for the grocery staple ahead of the November midterm election. Trump, in an August 21st post on Truth Social, said he reached a deal for foreign ground beef exporters to sell their product at a 25% discount in exchange for not paying U.S. out-of-quota tariffs on foreign beef. The president is expected to sign an executive order within the next 2 weeks formalizing the move, a White House official said. This deal will reduce prices for Americans while giving space for our great American beef herd to grow again, Trump said. The price of beef and veal was up 9.4% in July over the previous year, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, as year-over-year inflation eased slightly from June. Trump's move comes as imported beef has increased dramatically, up 122% in 5 years, according to the American Farm Bureau Federation, as the supply of domestic cattle remains at multi-decade lows following years of drought, the spread of the parasitic New World screwworm near the Mexican border, and other factors. The National Cattlemen's Beef Association criticized Trump's plan. While Americans' cattle producers share the goal of keeping groceries affordable for consumers, flooding the market with government-subsidized, below-market beef is not the way to rebuild the American cattle herd, the group said in a statement. Under the tariff quota system, varying amounts of imported beef from each country can be imported into the United States at substantially lower tariffs before higher out-of-quota tariff supply. A White House official who discussed the move on the condition of anonymity said Trump's deal on ground beef is intended to be a short-term action to fill a gap to meet consumer demand. The Trump administration will simultaneously work with ranchers to expand domestic beef production for the long term, the official said. The president declined to say which nations were part of the agreement. Senator Tim Sheehy, Republican from Montana, a Trump ally from one of the nation's largest cattle states, said he urged the president not to take the action, saying it will further harm ranchers, most of whom are MAGA Republicans. Senator Deb Fischer, Republican from Nebraska, another state where ranching is central to the economy, said she's extremely disappointed by Trump's decision. We all want lower grocery prices, but as I've said for months, we cannot do it at the expense of American producers, Fischer said. Flooding the market with foreign beef hurts our livestock industry and undermines the long-term solution, growing the U.S. cattle herd to meet demand. Iran says threatened U.S. sanctions will fail. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who is due to hold a press conference at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on August 24th, has threatened to impose the toughest sanctions in history on Iran. Iran's economy is already under major pressure from international sanctions, its infrastructure has been hit repeatedly, and thousands of people have been killed in airstrikes on the Islamic Republic since the United States and Israel launched its attacks on February 28th. But Tehran remains defiant after nearly 6 months of war and has brought shipping to a virtual standstill in the Strait of Hormuz, refusing to allow unauthorized oil tankers to transit a waterway that is vital for global oil shipments. The effective blockade of the strait has pushed up global oil prices. Describing what he said were repetitive scenarios, Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said in a video posted on Telegram that The fact that the U.S. leaders have moved on from military operations to bring up the same old plan shows that they are desperate. He said Washington must speak to Iran respectfully to find a solution based on justice and honor. We have never been afraid, he added. All of their actions, whether blockades or other military moves they have made, have failed, and this new issue of theirs will fail as well. President Donald Trump has warned of economic consequences against any country that provides any type of lifeline to Iran, and Bessent has urged cooperation with Washington by China, which buys more than 80% of Iran's shipped oil, according to 2025 data from analytics firm Kepler. China has urged diplomacy. Iran said Pakistan's army chief, Asim Manir, would visit Tehran on August 24th as part of efforts to restore peace and security in the region, but gave few details. Pakistan has been mediating in the conflict, and a Pakistani government source said Manir would address recent developments, including the threat of new U.S. sanctions. Trump said on August 21st that Washington was observing what happens in the conflict. They would love to make a deal, but they're not ready to make the right deal, in my opinion, Trump said of Iran. U.S. attacks have severely diminished Iran's economy and devastated its Navy and Air Force, but Tehran maintains enough missile and drone capability to impede oil tanker traffic and attack regional rivals. Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagha Ghalibaf said on August 22nd that Tehran had received numerous messages from neighboring countries about establishing new regional security arrangements and economic cooperation. I'm sorry, that's all we have time for today.